of high school and match him up with a general manager who might be typically middle-aged, who had negotiated hundreds, if not thousands, of contracts, who had enough data, comparative salary data on hand to know everything about the salary structure. If he didn't have it at hand, he could, with a phone call or two or three or four, to other general managers. It was considered perfectly fair to sit down with an untutored 18 or 19-year-old and forbid him to have an agent. If the player accepted what was offered, and most of the time he had a theoretical option of saying no and going into the next year's draft and wasting a whole year, as it were, or part of a year. But realistically, he was made to understand he had no choice. So you accepted whatever the club offered. Once you signed that contract, you became the property, literally the property, of that organization, and remained the property of that organization for all the rest of your career, unless they decided to sell you for cash or to trade you for another player or players to another organization. You had no say in when that happened. When it happened, you went where you were told. And you could not say no at that point. Having become a piece of property,
Maybe I can help fill that out. It means that if you didn't sign a contract for the next year, under the contract you had previously signed, the club reserved the rights to you
services
indefinitely. And so that reserve language is why it's called the reserve clause.
Yes, absolutely right. And what it meant, as you pointed out, is your contract could expire, but you still had no right to play baseball for a living with another team in the major leagues or the minor leagues or the United States, later Canada, not Canada either, or Puerto Rico or Venezuela or the Dominican Republic, or because of a letter agreement between the Commissioner of Baseball in Japan and the Commissioner of Baseball in the United States, you could not play in Japan.
And you were in an industry, let me see if I can paint another thing for these people 50 years from now. You were in an industry where the antitrust laws didn't apply because of a decision by the Supreme Court. So you talk about having a bad set of hands. You were in a terrible fix. The other clubs couldn't compete against each other because they could be ordered not to.
Exactly right. And so there you were. You were property. Now, anybody who would think about this will know why salaries were fairly miserable. If you don't have any bargaining power, in most cases, you're going to be discriminated against in terms of salaries and benefits. You have no place else to go.
Now go back to the meeting with Bunning, and were they interviewing other people in addition to you? How was it sort of presented to you? Were you the top choice? Were they saying, if you take the job, we'd like to have you? How did that develop?
Well, this was a long meeting in which, you know, I really was anxious to get input from them, and I was having a very difficult time. And what I learned came like a body blow. It was clear from the conversation back and forth that Roberts, whom I had never met before, was my most important backer. He was fairly impressed with me, that was clear. And he began to talk about what was ahead. And he said, you know, there are other candidates. I said, how many? And he said, five others. Okay. And he said, we are going to have to go back to the player reps of each club, the elected player representatives, and they will make a decision on who their nominee will be. And he said, nominee? He said, yes. And then you'd be subject to an election by all of the players in the major leagues. And I said, okay. And he said, and all the coaches and all the managers and all the trainers, management employees. I said, how did that come about? And he said, well, you know, they're covered by the pension plan. And so, you know, when you negotiate pensions, you'd be representing them. So, so that was the first time I realized it was going to be management people voting on this.
It was, to say the least, cumbersome.
Yes. And then Roberts, who you know, clearly had done the most thinking about this whole problem. He said, you know, these are not his exact words, but his meaning was, he said, I'm quite impressed with you. I'd like to have you. But you have to remember that the players are basically conservative. And you come from a union. And they are not unionists. And he said, I don't have to tell you about anti-union propaganda. It's all over, you know. So he said, we had the idea, and although he said we, I think it was his idea, that we'll have a ticket, a voting ticket, and you will be the candidate for executive director, and we need a conservative, a balanced ticket, in other words, who would be general counsel. At this point, I felt that, you know, the other shoe was about to fall, but I listened, and he said, as a matter of fact, we've already been to see someone who is interested. He would not be the general counsel himself, but his firm would be. And he is a conservative, and we think it would be a good ticket. And I said, you're going to tell me his name? And that's when he said, Richard Nixon. Mm. Well, at that point, I said it couldn't work. And Robbie's face just fell. He had, politically, he was sound. He was doing the right thing. And why wouldn't it work? You know? And so I said, well, consider. You've got a budget. We had already discussed that. You're going to have just two professionals. You're going to have a director and a general counsel, and there'll be one secretary and maybe one administrative person. That's it. I said, in that kind of a small organization, you can't have two people who are as incompatible as Richard Nixon and me. I said, you know, the Steelworkers Union, we had a staff of 1,000 people. And you want diversity. And so you can tolerate diversity with 1,000 people. With two, you can't.
Yeah.
And I said, besides, I don't think he's really the person for this job. You have stressed to me how important a pension plan is. I don't think he would know the difference between a pitcher's mound and the Empire State Building and a pension plan.
But isn't that fair? I'm thinking about these guys. In a way, we have to tip our hat to them, because those guys were being very courageous. Now, fact that they wanted a balanced ticket was their way of saying, we're frightened. We don't want to get too far ahead.
Right.
And I think you might want to spell that out, because again, yeah, 50 years from now, people will wonder why they weren't more aggressive. They weren't more aggressive because they were concerned.
Absolutely.
They were afraid.
Absolutely. I've described the kind of control there always was of players under the reserve system, and baseball being the monopoly exempt from antitrust restrictions, as you pointed out. And you translate that into an ability to dump all but the top superstars into oblivion. And
with no hope.
Right, right. And so, of course, they were afraid. And I agree with you that that was a most courageous thing, the whole process that they started.
And there were others beside them. I know Kiner early on.
Oh, yeah.
There were a lot of people who took enormous risks to their careers. Some of them were, yeah. as these guys were, really good players.
Yeah.
But they had a lot of guts.
Right. Yeah, and later on, as you
the meeting, the famous meeting, and how you became selected and your discussions with Roberts. And
right. Well, as I mentioned, the idea of Richard Nixon being the general counsel for his firm hit me like a ton of bricks.
Let me interrupt you. It's important for people, again, to realize he was out of politics. He was practicing law in New York. And he was available for hire.
Yes. Well, not really. As you
by
know,
hire, I mean his firm was in business to do work.
Oh, yes. Yes, sure. Yeah, he had been vice president for two terms under Eisenhower. He had run unsuccessfully for governor of California.
In 62?
Yes, I think so. And he had run unsuccessfully for president before that.
Mm-hmm.
And and now he is with a major firm, Nixon, Mudge, Rose.
Correct.
And other names in New York. And one of the things I said to the three players on the search committee was, first of all, as far as I know, he has never had any experience with pension plans, and you've labeled that as an important interest of the players. Secondly, he's a friend of all the owners. Haven't you seen him in the boxes with at any rate, and I explained about how he basically is an anti-trade unionist. I couldn't work with him. And I finished it up by saying, and besides, you know, even if you got him, it wouldn't be for long. He's going to run for president again. And I remember Bunning saying to me, how do you know that? And I said, well, I don't really know it, but all he's done since he came to New York in the Nixon Mudge Rose firm is travel around the country raising money at Republican money raisers. And he's piling up political debts here to him, and he's almost certain going to run for president again. Unfortunately, I was right, but at any rate, the conversation dwindled down. And you know, if you're at all sensitive to these things, you know the meeting's over. And so I get up and I shook hands all around and. I started to leave, and I came back and I said, look, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm going to give you advice you haven't asked for. I said, look, whoever you get for director, let him pick his own counsel. It's only going to be the two of them there. They have to really be compatible. Sure, hold him responsible for whatever happens and the activities of his counsel, but let him pick him. Mm-hmm. And I walked out. Went back to Pittsburgh, and my wife and son and daughter were anxiously awaiting, and I said, I blew it. We're not going back to New York. But I was wrong. Various things happened that are not that important. And they came back to me and said, okay, if you will be a candidate and if you are elected, you pick your own counsel. The arrangement was made before the players, coaches, trainers, and managers voted. I said, I want an opportunity to meet with them all. I want them to see who I am. I want to be able to talk to them. And so they said, okay. We arranged a spring training trip. It was already late when they nominated me. March was already here. But arranged for the trip. There were then 20 clubs in the majors. And it was decided that I would start in California, where the Angels were training, because I had a meeting with Kaiser Steel the next day. And then from there to Arizona, where the three other teams trained in the West, and then to Florida, where the final 16 teams were.
Now, Marvin, why were you interested in the job? I mean, what led you to, I know baseball, and I went to work for them too, maybe for the same reason, but what made this something that would take you from your the cherished steelworkers, where you were obviously on a line to be a significant player?
Well, first there was something that had happened in the steelworkers union. Kind of a most unusual happening. It has happened before, but unusual. The sitting secretary treasurer, I.W. Abel, decided to challenge McDonald for the presidency. They had four-year terms in office, and McDonald's third term was coming to an end at right about the time we're talking. And the Abel campaign, unfortunately, just split that union down the middle.
And you had to pick sides?
Well, sometimes I think I lead a charmed life. Both Abel and McDonald came to me separately and said, we hope that you will stay out of this. They had talked to each other. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, we want you to stay no matter which one of us wins. And so
that would have made it very hard to leave baseball. To leave for baseball.
Right. But I stayed through the election. Abel won. And then all kinds of things which I felt were un-trade union-like began to happen. That split down the middle was throughout the membership, throughout the district directors, throughout the staff, throughout the headquarters staff. You had people who felt that the election had been stolen, much like the Kennedy-Nixon thing had developed, and more for the people down 50 years down the road, like happened in the year 2000 in the presidential election here. And people had such heartfelt feelings about what had happened, and I found that I was well able to take care of myself in terms of the backbiting that was going on. But I found myself spending more and more time in the political arena, which I didn't want, than I was in the trade union arena. It really was difficult to visualize that union coming together.
Baseball came along at just the right time in
exactly.
one sense.
Exactly. The other thing, I still had close friends and associates and family members who said, "What are you doing? Mm-hmm. You've been here 16 years. You're well thought of. This is a prestigious union, et cetera. You're going to something that's been a company union that has never been effective in baseball. They don't have any money. They don't have any staff. They don't have any office. What are you doing?" And I found it hard to explain to them, but not hard to explain it to myself. My feeling was, having looked at the situation closely, it was that I couldn't fail. Things were so bad there, in my view, that anything I did was going to be a big improvement. And I really couldn't fail in that sense. And the other thing, it occurred to me one day that one of my beliefs was going to be tested. And that is that the most effective way to educate a membership is one-on-one and talking directly to them. Written memorandums are fine. Union newspapers and union magazines are fine. Conventions are fine. And district conferences are fine. But there's nothing like meeting in small groups.
How about a little moral outrage? Wasn't there part of you that said,
I
can take these guys on and...
Well, I don't know about taking them on, but I did feel that the conditions were just absolutely miserable. And I was a little ashamed of myself that I hadn't realized this when I was, quote, a fan. That, sure, I was properly indignant when they barred blacks from baseball. But I had never focused on the individual working conditions of the players who were there. I was a little ashamed of myself. This had all been going on while I was a paying customer, et cetera, et cetera. So there was that too. But I also felt that if a steelworkers union official wanted to meet with the entire membership, he'd have to live to be older than Methuselah. Mm-hmm. Just impossible. 1.25 million people. But here, there were going to be, on the active roster, there were going to be 500 people. And the thought came to me that I could meet with them not just once a year, I could meet with them several times a year. I could meet with whole clubs, I could meet with part of a club, I could meet with, and this was really going to be an opportunity to test some theories I had.
Now, did you talk to people like Goldberg or others for advice, and did anybody encourage you to take it, whose advice you valued?
No. I didn't talk with Goldberg about it. He was no longer there. He, as you know, he had gone from being Secretary of Labor to a member of the Supreme Court, and as a Justice of the Supreme Court, he became Ambassador to the United Nations. And that's where he was at this point in time. And I had no longer really had contact with him.
But was there anybody who gave you advice to take it, whose advice you respected?
No.
So all the advice was negative?
All the advice was negative. And the funny part about this was that Abel and McDonald had grown to be arch enemies in that election dispute. But I have to tell you a story that was so kind of important. I had mapped out the trip to meet with all the 20 clubs, and the first one was to be the Angels, and they were training in Palm Springs. And I had a meeting the day before with the Kaiser Steel people in San Francisco. And Abel had become president by this time. And I flew with him out to the coast. And the next morning, I was a little late to the meeting of the Kaiser Steel Committee. And you know how this sometimes happens? You walk into a room full of people who are talking, you can hear the hum of conversation, and you walk in and there's dead silence. And you wonder, you know, is it me? What happened? And I soon learned that what happened, they were waiting for the meeting to start, and they were reading that morning's San Francisco Examiner. And their heading, California Angels players blast Miller. And then they've got quotes from the player rep, Bob Rogers. We don't want no union bosses. Joe Adcock. I've forgotten all the names, but prominent players, et cetera, et cetera. And all on the front page of the paper. Well, you know, we put the paper away, we had a meeting, and came time for the luncheon adjournment, and I went out with somebody and had lunch, and I came back, and the hotel we were meeting was in a little park, and I sat down by myself in the park to think about this a little. I had a meeting the next morning with the Angels.
You had not been elected, so you were still thinking about the job.
Right.
You had